Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
Each night we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry.
Todd Rutherford back with his founder of AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of over 2,500 different books and still counting. Todd, hi, welcome back.
Good to be here, Michael.
Oh, how are you doing? Did you survive the weather and everything?
Actually, it's been really nice this week. It was in the 70s today, and they're saying it's going to be in the 70s again tomorrow.
Well, I love every second of that. Oklahoma, you guys got nailed with some of that bad weather, didn't you?
We sure did, yeah. Fortunately, we didn't have quite as many tornadoes touch down here as they did in the other states, but we'd have our prayers go out to all the families affected by the devastation of these storms.
Sure. No, absolutely. No question about it. Let's go to issue. You know, that one of the things that I really love about talking to you is that with all of the exposure that you have, there's so much to learn from those people who, quote unquote, have been there and done that. Have you got one of the authors that you've dealt with that we could really learn something from?
Well, actually, recently I came across an author that his success story, he's a younger guy and a relatively new success story and kind of has some really fun things to say. I follow his blog and actually, send stuff to my followers on Twitter and so on and so forth from him. And I was taking a look at his blog post this week. His name is Austin Kleon, and he's actually a writer and artist living in Austin, Texas. He's the author of a new book called Newspaper Blackout. It's currently number 15 on the poetry bestseller list on Amazon, and it's in the top 10,000 best-selling books in the world on Amazon, which is pretty significant considering sure. Amazon has more than 7 million books on its database. So basically, there's a couple of key points that he talks about on this blog that I thought, man, I would really like to talk about there because there's some fascinating perspectives and some thought-provoking talk for Dresser After Dark.
Yeah, that was good. I got that. Everybody here applauded.
So yeah, definitely want to check him out at Austin Kleon at kleon.com. But he's gotten on his blog post this week. He's the title is "How to Steal Like an Artist and 9 Other Things Nobody Told Me."
I love that.
So I'm not gonna. We won't have time to necessarily go over all 9, but there's a couple of them that I picked out that I really thought, you know, between you and I, we've got some pretty amazing stories we could say.
Sure.
Number 2 out of the first 9, he says, "Don't wait until you know who you are to start making things happen."
I love that.
You know, he talks about there was a video that went around last year of Ray Wilson, the guy who plays Dwight on The Office. You may not have ever watched The Office, but the under 45 crowd watches it pretty religiously. But he was talking about in the video, Ray Wilson was talking about creative block, and he said something that really drove Austin nuts. He said that if you don't know who you are or what you're about and what you believe, then it's really pretty impossible to be creative. And what Austin said as a response to that, that I just really resonated with me, and I believe it's what I want to make sure that authors and, you know, artists are thinking this way, is if you waited until you knew who you were and what you were about before you started being creative, you'd still be sitting around trying to figure that out instead of making things happen. And, you know, it's always best to go ahead and start things, because it's in the act of making things happen that we figure out who we are, that our skills begin to come to the surface. I don't know how many authors I've spoken to that, you know, just recently, in fact, today, an author that I helped publish and write, his name is Rudolf Kloop. The book's called A Garden Enclosed, and it's his first novel, and it's a really well-written, powerful novel that I believe has tremendous potential. And we're in the process of getting it marketed, actually. But, you know, he's already started on a second novel, and he asked me today, he said, you know, I never would have considered myself a novelist. It's not something that I ever thought of doing. But it's something that, as he began to start doing it one time, he just decided, you know what, he came up with a little idea for a story, and he just began to write. And he found himself, as he was writing, really enjoying it, and it flowing naturally for him, creating these fictional characters and their worlds and the conflicts and that between the characters. And, you know, he said, should I continue along this path of becoming, you know, being an author? And I told him, I said, well, you know, first of all, he has a gift. Not everybody has a gift. It's like everybody can learn how to write mechanically, but there's a gift of storytelling that just comes natural. And, you know, it's like, I remember, that reminds me of another story, quick segue. My wife and I one time went to hear one of the, I was assistant professor at Oklahoma State University in the music department, and he was doing a piano concert. And this is a small setting on, you know, maybe 50 people or so. After he got done playing four or five different pieces that were just unbelievable, I remember walking up to him and saying, you know, I can mechanically play. I understand the chords and the notes and the scales. And I said, with a lot of practice, is it possible for me to be as good as you are? Or is there a certain level of giftedness that has to be present? And he said, anybody can learn to play the piano and play it well. But he said, to be a master piano player, you have to have a certain level of natural giftedness that's present. And I believe that's the same way about writers. There is a certain level of natural giftedness that is either there or not there. But, you know, the important thing is, whatever it is, whether it's writing or speaking or painting or sports or whatever that you choose to, you know, try to pursue, you know, don't worry about trying to figure it out as the bottom line. Just get out there and do something and let your talents and your gifts and your abilities develop as a result of that process.
You know, I'm listening to you very closely, and what I'm hearing out of this, it's not who you think you are that limits you. It's who you really are if you allow it to come out.
Exactly. You don't ever create a definition. Well, I've never been able to do that, or I've never done that way, that thing.
Sure.
Or one of the things that a lot of writers, I read a manuscript yesterday that was submitted to me, and I mean, it was amazing. I can tell by reading the first chapter or two if somebody has a gift. And I mean, this story is amazing. It captured me, it brought me in, it created an experience that I wasn't expecting. It took me places and I thought I had figured out. Just within a couple of chapters, I was drawn in, like, you know, reading something from a master storyteller. And when I get on the phone with this gal and I talk to her, I ask her, I said, okay, what university did you go to? What's your master's degree? Is it in creative writing, or is it in English, or is it in, you know, historical literature? And she said, no, she said, other than high school, I've never had any training before. And I'm just sitting there going, you don't have a clue how good you are. Your talent is absolutely astounding, you know, but she didn't know it. She didn't try to go, well, this is what I'm going to be, and, you know, but she enjoyed it, and she decided that she just wanted to start to write a story. So don't ever try to define things by what you, you know, have tried before or what anybody else has said. Just, you know, you have to be willing to completely open yourself up and just pursue whatever you're passionate about and give it a shot. and let the talents manifest themselves in that process.
You know, there's this old adage, and the old adage is taught, it's thinking outside the box. And if you truly want to define that, we all think pretty much the same thoughts. We mix them up, and they come out a little bit different, but they're the same thoughts. Thinking outside the box, truly, the definition is thinking thoughts you didn't think that you could think. And that's really where the key is, opening it up. I'm going to go back to where I was a moment ago. Most people define themselves. And when you define, you're saying this, I'll say it in a different way, you limit yourself. And that limitation causes the outcome of your life. It's who you really are inside that if you just allow it to flow, it's who you'll become. And that who you become is who you always were that was masked.
Yes, exactly. One of the other things that he said in this blog post that he put together, Austin, he said, write the book that you want to read, you know, and he tells a story about how, you know, you can tell how young he is because he says Jurassic Park came out on his 10th birthday. And I'm sitting there going, wow, that makes me feel old.
That's
but he said, you know, that he was obsessed with that movie, and as soon as he left the movie, he sat down at his computer and began to type out the sequel to that movie. You know, and he said, in his treatment, the game warden got eaten by the velociraptors and blah, blah, blah. But the powerful thing is that he wrote what he thought would happen. He wrote the book that he would be excited about, that would work for him. And that's another thing that I encourage authors to do, is don't worry about trying to write something that you think would be what people are expecting or looking for. Just write what you want to read. Write what's exciting to you. Write what you would enjoy, what you would benefit from. If you're wanting to, you know, nonfiction's the game, then write about some research and write about something that you're fascinated with, even if it's not something that is an area of expertise for you. These are all just great ways of developing your talent, getting material put out there, and, you know, giving yourself a chance to develop your craft.
Todd, over the years, I've probably interviewed literally thousands of authors, you know, from all the way, all those years back. And the one thing that I found, which is very interesting, when you're saying let it go, if you take a look at the title, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, it doesn't really matter. Take a look at the title, and what you're dealing with is that's who the author is inside. They may frame it two or three dimensions away from themselves, and it could be a vampire movie. But it might have been somebody who was sucking the emotions out of them as a kid. But if you really look at it, it's them. It's them that they're talking about.
And even authors in interviews will often say, in a work of fiction, that every character in the book is modeled after an aspect of their characteristic or their history or time in their life where they were in discovering it, and there was a time that they were real, you know, kind of outgoing, or there was a time that they were real moody, or there was a time, you know, and they develop a lot of, or even in their own lives, sure, not that they have multiple personality disorder, but,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
But that there are moments in our lives that we act in certain ways and patterns and you know, form entire characters for stories based on that.
Who was it that wrote, what was it, The Deep Heart of the Ocean? Who was it?
Jackie
Bouchard. Bouchard, you know who that is?
Yes, sir.
Okay, no, and she was a guest, so this isn't speaking out of school. This came out over the air. Jackie was with us about 2 years ago, and we did a live interview with her. And as I got into it, the book, which turned into a movie that she wrote, were about a bunch of women who went out on vacation. Something happened that the crew and the captain died, and they were fighting pirates off, right? And as I dug into it, Todd, which was very interesting, Jackie, and this was on the air, so this isn't something that we shouldn't say, but Jackie had said that years ago her husband passed away. When he passed away, she had been a housewife. She didn't do anything with the accounting. She didn't do anything with the checkbook. She didn't work. She was a homemaker, and all of a sudden she got thrown out into the world, and she had to survive. And if you really got down to it, that movie was about her survival, framed in such a way that it was the sea, it was pirates, etc., but it was her.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you find it time and again. The only person that I don't see a coordination between who they are inside and what they say is somebody who was pushing health care. I guess it was. I had to do it. It was Nancy.
Well, do we have a minute or two to go to say one more thing, or do we need to put it off till next week?
So I couldn't understand what you said.
I said, do we have a couple more minutes, or do
go ahead, please.
Well, the last area that I always get is, you know, how do I get my work out there? How can I get exposure to people? And he says the secret on his body, he said, do good work and put it where people can see it. You know, it sounds simple, but it is much more simple today than it ever has been before in history. It used to be extremely difficult to get exposure, and it still takes work and effort, and of course professionals can help you do it on a faster and broader scale. But the bottom line is, with Kindle, with blogs, with forums, and all kinds of opportunities for self-publishing content digitally, even in print, it's much more feasible to get content put together and out there inside of an audience. And if you put something in front of people and they begin to enjoy it, they'll begin to tell other people about it. And, another thing he says, step one is wonder about something in front of people and then invite other people to wonder with you.
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely great. The imagination, there's, you know, we have limitations in our life. Here comes that word again, limitations. But Todd, when you think about it, when you wonder, when you use your imagination, there are no limits. There's absolutely no boundaries, and you can move. That scares some people, but the people who get it, they're the ones who move with it, put it to pen, and who knows what gets created from there.
Exactly.
And we love every second of it. We're starting to run out of time. Question. Website we can find you at.
AskThePublishingGuru.com is the best way to find out why I'm at. That's the place where I hang out, and all the connections, where you can connect with me on Twitter and Facebook and email and telephone, and more than 300 articles on writing, publishing, and marketing books. And I'll help folks in any way I can.
Love every second of it. Todd Rutherford, see you next week.
See you next week.
Take care. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you.
Gotcha.
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. But that's all.
Ann Holmes with us, and she's the Chief Clinical Officer at. I was going to do some music there. It's coming in from space. It must have been. She's the Chief Clinical Officer at Eden Autism Services. She provides nationwide consultations, training, and presentations on assessment, behavioral, social, communication, and academic issues in autism for both families and professionals. She's an MA in speech pathology and is a board-certified behavioral analyst. She's an annual presenter at the National Conference for the Autism Society of America, Autism New Jersey, and the Association for Behavior Analysis. Anne, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, so glad to be on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the autism, there was a time 5-10 years ago, you know, we heard about it, but it wasn't as prevalent as it is today. More and more people are beginning to understand it. So let's lay a base and start out with what is autism, and then we can work upward from there.
Sure. Autism is a brain disorder, and we've sort of clarified that over the years, that it's not an emotional disorder. It's a brain disorder. And it's a disorder that significantly impacts the way information is processed in the brain. So individuals with autism are not processing information the way we all are, and it manifests itself in challenges with behavior, communication, learning, and social behavior.
Now, the processing in and of itself, is that a chemical imbalance? It's got to be a disconnect somewhere. Do we have a handle on exactly what it is?
No. I mean, the researchers are sure it's a brain disorder, and they're looking at clearly looking at brain abnormalities in structure and function of brain. But as much as we know, there's still so much we really don't know about why this disorder exists.
Now, a child with autism today, is it possible for that child to live, whatever normal means, is it possible for that child to live a reasonably normal life?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. We know so much about best practices in treatment, and the earlier the intervention can happen, research is showing that makes a significant difference. Individuals with autism, they don't outgrow it. However, they can clearly learn skills to reach potential and to live the most productive, independent lives as possible.
Now, we're looking at social skills that are usually way behind everybody else's. Can someone have autism and it be, when I say minor, it not be to the degree where it's quote-unquote that noticeable, and they go through it, they go through school, they don't talk to people, they seem into themselves, they seem separated from everyone else, people start to make fun of them, and all of a sudden they're the ones that go home crying. Are there kids who don't know and parents who don't know their children have autism because it is such a minor degree they have it, yet the effect is there? Can that happen?
Oh, absolutely. And I think we're getting better at diagnosing those kids younger. I think there's a whole slew of older kids and adults with autism that have autism but don't know it, and you put it perfectly. It's, you know, they go through life and they struggle with these social situations, don't know why, but it really is, in the end, it's autism.
Now, is there anything that looks like autism that isn't? Because where I'm going with this is, can it be misdiagnosed into something else, and then the family is working on something that doesn't exist, and at the same time, the problems are still going on. Is it that easy to spot autism today?
Actually, I believe we are getting good at spotting it and sort of separating it from other potential disabilities or challenges. Clearly, there still can be misdiagnosis. I would say typically with the individuals you just described that sort of have, you know, sort of those mild symptoms, they're just not diagnosed and they're sort of struggling. I think kids can be diagnosed with learning disabilities or with even psychiatric issues when in reality it's a diagnosis of autism.
Now, are there medications that are prescribed, or is it behavioral, or is it a combination of both? Are we dealing with a behavioral problem?
The treatment of choice for educating students with autism and dealing with adults with autism really is, it's a behavioral approach, not dealing with behavior, but it's about teaching and exposing them to situations and reinforcing them in those situations. And there's great research and great success in practice structured teaching of teaching even social skills. You know, this is how you need to behave in the situation. This is how you should best initiate contact with a peer. I think we have such great knowledge and experience in terms of how we should best educate students with autism to lead them to productive adulthood. Medication is getting the whole field of psychopharmacology in terms of, you know, treating disorders with medication. It's improving, but it's clearly not the answer. Typically, individuals with autism who are on medication are being treated for very specific, almost additional disorders like anxiety or maybe explosive behavior or even something like maybe, you know, a psychiatric issue. So clearly, medication is not the answer. We're getting better at supporting people with autism with medication, but it is really just continuing to educate people on best practices.
So along with autism, you just mentioned it, they could have ADHD, they could have, you could be talking about OCD, you can be talking about many things that could be part of that diagnosis. I imagine that it does hide itself.
Absolutely. But you know, you brought it up before, I think that social deficit is the area that jumps out when we're doing a diagnostic evaluation. So even if a child or an adult has, you know, characteristics of OCD or, like you said, ADHD or whatever,
sure.
It really is that social disconnect that sort of jumps out and sort of leads us to that diagnosis of autism.
Now, what about adults today? You know, there was a time the adults got packed away. They just, they got, quote unquote, put in the closet, stuck under the rug so nobody had to see them. What about adults today? Are there places adults can go where they are around people that are like them? Is there help? Are there, what's the word I want to use? Is there support systems for adults with this problem?
This is really where I think we're in a national crisis. There are programs across the nation that offer services for adults with autism. They are very, very few and far between, and clearly we have more adults with autism that are sitting home than are in any appropriate kind of program.
I think one of the things that people have to look at, and with any kind of a debilitating disease, and no matter what degree that it is, we're dealing with that. That child may have autism, but the entire family has it, quote unquote. Because now, if you're concentrating on that one child, which you should, because that child can't keep up with the rest of them, you've got the other children in the family now feeling separated, left out, pushed away because of that. You've got the people that you run around with. You've got your relatives and everybody's talking. So when somebody has autism, it's the entire family that has it. And the support system not only should be for the child, but that family that's involved also. There's a myriad of problems that people don't think about.
No, absolutely. And like I said, there in the educational years, okay, there are clearly more supports for the student with autism and actually their families in terms of, you know, support groups and in-home services. But you're so on in the fact that this impacts the entire family. And when we go back to adults with autism, the 70s, not the stereotype, but many mothers, you know, stayed at home and the fathers worked. If there was an individual with autism who was an adult, the family dynamics may have supported it minimally. Now we're living in an age where, you know, both parents are working, and, you know, I just can't even imagine how you have a child with autism who has been through good programming and good education, turns 21, and, you know, it finishes that 21st year, and suddenly they're home, and one of the parents has to potentially, you know, quit their job or spend a significant amount of money to pay for care.
Now, what do we do about that today? Are there groups, are there organizations, 501(c)s, nonprofits, someplace that has help for the families and not only those kids that are involved in this that do have what would you call it? It's not a disease. What is it?
No, it's really a brain disorder. It's a brain disorder. It's developmental in nature, meaning it develops in early childhood. In terms of supports for post 21, there are very few. It's really a sad state of affairs when you have an entitlement system. So every child with a disability is entitled by federal law to receive a free and appropriate education. So, and now we know so much about autism and good, you know, how to provide best practices in the public school environment. So they have these, you know, let's say really fantastic, you know, years of education. And seriously, at 21, when they're finished that year, there are little to no supports for families. And that is why it's such a an important issue to discuss, because the increasing number of people with autism and the numbers of you know, students with autism that are graduating, you know, and turning adults, it's a significant issue for this country.
No question. Now, isn't there something very much like autism that's a it was in the forefront of my head. I was thinking about it. There is something like autism, but it isn't quite autism. And there's a lot of kids who have it, and it's Asperger's. There we go. Asperger's. That's a social problem for most kids, and they don't know that they have it. And now when they understand it and they have help with it, they move through it. And as adults, they can overcome for the most part. But isn't Asperger's a dimension of autism?
Yes. Right now, Asperger's syndrome is on the autism spectrum. It's on, obviously, the high-functioning end of autism. It's labeled differently, you know, I think for that reason, because you're talking about, you know, Asperger's, individuals with Asperger's have, if not a normal IQ, a high IQ, where if you look at autism, about 70% of people with autism have some level of cognitive deficit. So Asperger's individuals, you know, like I say, have so many great skills in terms of intellect, but I have to tell you something, they still struggle to overcome it. I know many people with autism who got college degrees and even master's degrees and can't get a job because of that social component. So while they may understand it, they still struggle significantly with being able to navigate the whole social world.
But how do you deal with that? And obviously you work with people behaviorally. Someone has that particular problem. Are there ways to move through it? Are there learned responses? Can someone actually move through it in such a way that they can deal with what's out there? They know they've got it. I mean, and the people around them know that they have it. But is there instruction for them? Is there some type of a learning program where they can go through and learn to navigate through social situations?
Absolutely. If the individual with Asperger's is motivated to, you know, they know, okay, I'm failing at this. You know, I want to get a job. I know I'm not able to navigate the interview or whatever. Clearly, with that motivation, there are absolutely strategies and supports that we can. We can present to the adult with Asperger's, or even the student with Asperger's, and it really is just giving them. It's sort of simple in a way. It's just really role playing and exposing them to the way, you know, you should respond in a situation, and continuing to expose them to it, role play, have them talk through scenarios, and if the motivation is there, which sometimes it's not, which then you don't have the hook to get that person to the next level, you can see the change. I don't know if you heard, but Temple Grandin is internationally known woman who has autism. She is incredibly high functioning. She has a degree in animal husbandry, which I really didn't know what it was till I knew about her. And she struggled her whole life with social situations. She had the motivation to learn, so people just talked her through things. As simple as her not having good hygiene at her first job, and her boss said to her, you know, Temple, you know, you need to shower daily, put on deodorant, et cetera, and she did. And, you know, so she was able to take all that feedback and integrate it. She didn't necessarily understand it as you know, again, she's a brilliant woman. But she was able to accept it and make those changes so that she could be successful.
Now, part of your talking points, which I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, there's got to be something here in the fix for this. I'm not going to use the word cure, obviously, but what you're saying, there's been a continued increase in the incidence of autism. Current ratio is 1 out of 101 births, etc. In the next 10 years, they're looking for it to increase. So my question really would be this: based on culture, tradition, geographic location, whatever we want to say, if there's an increase in it, there must be something stimulating that increase. That's where I think the scientists should truly look, because if there's an increase, there that means there's a change in something or more of. And if we can find what that common denominator is, that overarching theme, we might be able to get a handle on this.
Yes. There is some debate about the increase in incidence, and I think it makes sense. First of all, we are incredibly more aware of autism, and we have many, many more medical professionals that have experience, so diagnosis is better. In 1992, the criteria for autism expanded a bit, so we were looking at a wider range of autism. There clearly over the years, if you look at statistics, while there's been an increase in the incidence of autism, there's been a decrease in the diagnosis of other disabilities, such as maybe learning disabilities or mental retardation. So we look there, is there a little bit of a diagnostic substitution there? But I have to tell you, even with those factors, there is a clear focus on the part of researchers to try to understand, why is not only what is the cause of autism, which we don't know, but what is it that has made, this increase so dramatic?
Now, let me ask you a question. I know a kid about 18, 19 years old, and I was in the car with this kid about, three years ago. She had just gotten her driver's license, and her mother was in the car. I was in the car. And she's not family, and I know her, so it wasn't something I see every day. So she just got her driver's license, so I gave her the keys to drive my car. The three of us were in the car. She's driving down the street, and I'm watching her. I'm sitting on her right side, and I'm watching her getting closer and closer to a car. There's a car in front of us. If I hadn't say step on the whatever brakes, she may not have stepped on the brakes. Is that some form of the disconnect that we're talking about? Is that so minor that so many people have it that they're not aware of?
Yes, and I think what we find with individuals with autism is one of the symptoms is they struggle with problem solving. And I think your example was great of such a basic issue of problem solving. I need to stop. So that is definitely something that individuals with autism struggle with.
Yeah, and I've watched, and I've also watched when she gets under pressure. And by the way, she goes to college, etc. And she mm-hmm. has a great social life. But I've watched her when she gets under pressure, the eyes drop, the head goes down, and she gets very low and won't talk.
Yeah. No, I think you find, anxiety situations maybe for everyone, but for people with autism, clearly there's sort of that shutdown because they're just not processing it. They don't understand really what's going on, and that leads to the anxiety.
Now, how do you deal with that if you have somebody who takes, the anti-depression pills and so on and so forth? Is there, and what if the counselors, she's just one example of so many, but you're triggering me to think about these things, but what if the counselors that they would go to don't do this? Because I know there have been times these people cut themselves, etc. That's also a form of one of the symptoms of autism, what they do to each other or what they do to themselves. The potential suicides and the rest of it. What if the counselors miss it? What if they don't get that it could be a mild form of autism or Asperger's and they're off base? What do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, I want to hope that, in the year 2011, that awareness is good enough that most counselors would pick it up. I would also hope that most counselors would see that if the strategies they're using, that they would typically use, let's say they're not seeing the autism, but the strategies they're using aren't working, I hope ethically they do one of two things, either A, refer to another counselor, or sort of rethink what, this strategy isn't working, and do we have to go to another strategy? But I'm such a hopeful person that I think
sure.
that we're living in a world where I got to think that most counselors would pick it up.
Yeah, but Ann, what if they don't know? I think that's really the key. And it's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you don't know that you don't know that gets you in trouble.
You're right.
And the counselors don't know. There are debilitating diseases. There are things that people walk into a medical doctor's office with, and because the doctor is the doctor, and they're aware of how to use allopathic medicine, but they don't really know what the problem is. They haven't seen it. They haven't been exposed to it. That's obviously why we have our specialists. But I really believe what we're dealing with, especially with what you're dealing with, I think that's just coming to the fore right now, even with all the research and with all the study, it's getting to take shape. And if it takes shape, then somebody can grasp how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. I think like I said, I think we're getting to the place where I think people do understand it enough. And if a counselor fails,
yeah,
the individual they're serving fails.
But it's a failure. I guess that's really where I'm going with this. Is it a failure if they don't know? That's where it is, and I think there's where the problem
yes.
has been. Yeah.
I think you're absolutely correct. I said if they don't know, they have potential to absolutely miss it, and then the individual that they're you know working with, is going to just spiral down.
Sure, and look how many cases of ADHD that are diagnosed, and the kid really doesn't have ADHD. It's something else that looks like it, and I
mm-hmm.
think that's what
mm-hmm.
we're really seeing today. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at? And if anybody wants to help and participate, we can send them where to go.
Yes, that would be absolutely fabulous. It's EdenAutismServices.org.
Wonderful. Hey, Ann, thank you so much for joining us, Ann Holmes, and I appreciate the time that you spent and the work that you do.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Take care. Good night.
All right, good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those I am sure have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you've adored for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Greg Lang's with us. Gregory Lang is with us. And the books are, and these are very special, Why a Daughter Needs a Mom, 100 Reasons. Why a Son Needs a Mom, 100 Reasons. Thank you, Mom, 100 Reasons. And Why I'm Grateful to You and Why I Love Grandma, 100 Reasons. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much. You know, the two series of inspirational gift books, and they're about romantic and family relationships, sold over 3 million copies. And you yourself, you're a child and family development doctor from the University of Georgia. And I think the real key is, Greg, most people have forgot what mom is. Mom is an institution, and we've lost it.
Indeed. Yeah, the world has changed in so many ways. I think about my own mother as we approach Mother's Day and the things that she did for me. And when I tell stories about her, my own daughter just kind of nods her head and goes, "You're kidding. She really did that."
Yeah.
My mother raised 4 kids, and she made sure that we all had a hot breakfast before we left to go to school. She mended our clothes and, you know, put Band-Aids on our cuts and bruises, and just so many, many things that I think now often you only see on television.
Oh, sure. I think the big difference, I remember one day I was in a friend of mine's yard, and we couldn't have been more than 12 years old, about a block and a half away from where I live. He's standing up on his garage. He's got a golf club in his hand, and I called him something, and he said, "If you call me that again, I'm going to throw the club." And I called it, and he hit me right in the head, and I am bleeding, right? And I went home, opened the door. She looked at me, and she said, "You get in here." She cleaned up my head, put a bandage on it, sent me back out to play. But those Mom loved it because she knew. She knew it was okay. Yeah. She knew she could handle it.
Oh, yeah. She knows what kind of son she was raising, and so I'm sure she wouldn't have sent you back out there if you were at any kind of risk at all, because moms are so protective. You know, that's one of the nice things about mom. They're kind of magical. They do want to protect you. They oversee you and see that you, you know, aren't taking too much risk, but they also know the value of risk and will let you spread your wings a little bit.
You know,
certainly my mom did for us.
Yeah, and the special day is coming up, Mother's Day. There's no question about that. And the way I have felt, my mom's been gone since 93. And the way that I felt about it, you know, afterwards, that we were complete. There wasn't anything she didn't know. She knew I loved her, and I know she loved me. I mean, we were solid that way, so it was good.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many people that they don't have that. And now there's things I would probably love to say to her, but she's not here to say it to. And I think Mother's Day is the time to say it. Just open it up and get it out, because you never know when it's too late.
Absolutely, and that's so true. You know, just last night I was watching a TV program, and the main character in the show started to cry as he was cooking a meal that he was preparing from his mother's recipe, and he said, "You only get one mom." And it's so true. There's no mulligan in mom. You know, you have to do the best that you can with the one that you've got while you have her. And we tend to get so wrapped up, especially youth and teens, get so wrapped up in the things that we want to do for ourselves to make us feel good and expect mom to be there to encourage and support that. But we really do need to stop and look back at her and realize, gosh, she's made so much happen for me. It's my time to support and encourage her, and to do that before it's too late.
You know what, the way we don't think about it, and it hit me loud and clear, even before she passed away, was that I was watching an old, it wasn't even a video, the old, however they made movies, right? And it was she and she and my brother when he was almost a baby, and the family, the uncles and the aunts and so on and so forth. There were kids, they were in their 20s. You don't even relate to them that way. Their mom and dad, they're older, and that's the end of it. But they were babies too. And what they learned, yeah. And they learned how to be moms from their moms and on and on and on. And there's things that they don't know. And just to be a mom is a very powerful thing. I mean, what more could somebody be to you?
Oh, my mother is still most fulfilled in her role as a mom. And she's in her early 70s. She was a school teacher for a while and worked in retail and had other jobs that she did now and then to help support the family. But when you ask her, what were you? Her answer will be that I was a mom, and she still is in so many ways. I have siblings that still live near her, and she sees them regularly, still cooks meals for them, and takes care of whatever matter she can handle, even though her youngest child is now 43 years old. She'll still do things for her.
There was three boys and a girl in the family. My dad passed away when I was, 7-8 years old, whatever it was, and she raised all of us. She never remarried again, but when we went to school, there was always new jeans, there was always clothes, there was always something. When I was 16, she made sure that I had a car, and she was a waitress at the local drugstore, and she was mom.
It's amazing how they can do all of that, and it just seems like they, you know, have a boundless strength. It's just always you know, on go, and you never see or seldom see mom just collapse and say, "I need a break from you." It just almost never occurs.
No. Today we have a different world, and I think more important that your message and your books need to be out there today. Mom has taken on a little different definition than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, and I think there has to be a resurgence in what mom is about, and for the boys, for the girls, for all of them. Because when it comes down to it, you said it, there's only one.
There's only one. You know, I come from a counseling background and spent most of my academic training in the 70s and 80s during a time when it was all about self-fulfillment and self-realization. And I think that changed the kinds of mothers that we later saw in the 90s and even maybe today, where sure, there was less of that sacrifice that you and I remember in our own mothers, who were products of a generation, a decade or two earlier. And you know, I hope that that's something that we will see a tide change in, where people go back to realizing that parenting is about loving indeed, but it's also about sacrificing and not doing everything that's going to make you happy first, and then you either live vicariously through your children or have them wait for you to see that your own needs are met.
Yeah, and that's true. And I think the relationships between moms and daughters and sons, they're completely different now. They're different in such a way that they take on a different definition. There's a feel to it. With the high technology age that we have, there's a sense of humanity that seems to have slipped away, and we depend less and less on the parents. You go all the way back to the originally when we started this country, and mom and dad were the most important thing in the world because they were responsible for teaching the child survival skills. And as mm-hmm. we grew, it got turned over to the government. I'm not being political, but that's where it was.
I agree completely. I absolutely agree with that. I've seen so many changes in our social support systems and the school systems that really encourage reliance on the bigger system and not so much on the family unit. And I think in many ways that's why the family unit, or at least the traditional unit, has deteriorated and certainly become smaller in prevalence in our country.
Absolutely. And this word love is a very interesting word today. This is why, again, I can't repeat it enough, that we have to retake a look at the relationships that we have with our families. Because once it's gone and you haven't got out what you need to get out, and I'm sure, as a therapist, you've run into it time and again where somebody's coming to you and they've had this tremendous problem, and the tremendous problem, if you trace it back, was the same problem that they had with mom or dad that they're having with their husband or wife right now. So if you don't clear it, yeah. If you don't clear it, it's going to haunt you, and you won't know what it is until it's too late.
That's true. And, it's a cliche to say that we have that baggage, but we really do. People carry injuries with them for years, if not all of their lives. And the experience in a family with a loving mom and dad and people that will put children first and take care of them and sacrifice for the well-being of the child really do raise good parents in the future generation. But, we have such young parents in so many cases today, and we do have parents that are not as committed to the child and expect the school to take care of them. Well, then that child isn't raised with the encouragement that they need, that then they can go on and encourage somebody else when they have their own child. I work with youth that are in either foster care or have only one parent raising them, and it's such a remarkable difference when you see their level of suspicion and unwillingness to have just relational intimacy with people compared to children that are still living at home with two parents that are just spending time doing the things that families used to do.
Sure, and one of the talking points that you have, and I think it's so important, is about showing gratitude and just saying thank you. It doesn't happen. Most of the time today, it's competition with mom or competition with dad, and we know more than they do.
Oh, yeah. Well, in this generation, I think that too many parents have made the mistake of wanting to be friends with their children instead of being the authority figure. And when you look at your parent as a friend, you don't really feel the need to express gratitude because, that's a peer, and you think that you're each bringing something to the relationship. Which is really the wrong dynamic. I love my children, and I'm grateful that they enjoy spending time with me, but I've never had the desire to be their friend. It's just the wrong relationship to have with them.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. I think it came up the other night in the air, and let me repeat it because it was very important. When my mom and myself, my relationship really came together, Greg, is when I allowed her to be my mother. Do you hear
mm-hmm.
it? When I allowed her... My mother, I was in Fairbanks, Alaska, 40, 45 degrees below zero, and I would talk to her on the phone, and she would say, Michael, don't forget to put a jacket on when you walk outside the house. now, Greg,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
I was just to this day, and I'm 50 years old, but I will call my mom and ask her how to do something, or I'll say, I forgot how to make this recipe, or how would you handle this? And, I may know, and if I don't know, I can certainly get on the Internet and figure it out very quickly, but it just delights her that I would still find her as a resource and call her and do just what you said, let her be mom. And
yeah,
it just,
absolutely.
It gives her the biggest kick to feel like I still need her enough that I would stop as an adult today and call her up on the phone and say, Mom, how do you do blank.
And by the way, the realization for me with that was basically this, that instead of letting her know that I was an adult and I could make my own decision about putting a jacket on when it was cold and acting like a child doing so, I became an adult, and it was okay, and it was fine to be that way. And once you allow your mom to be your mom and you to be their son or daughter, because you're always going to be the little one, I don't care how old you get, then all of a sudden life is different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No matter how old you get, you're always the child. I'm the oldest of five, and I almost think at times that my mother would not see me as a child anymore, but she would think of the youngest, my sister, as the real child in the family just because she was the baby. But, I talk to her regularly on the phone, and I still get, the advice that I haven't asked for, and I still get even the encouragement that I haven't asked for, but I certainly love to hear. It doesn't matter how accomplished I may be. She still wants to make sure that I can be the best and that I haven't forgotten anything and that all of my bases are covered, and she's going to ask the right questions to make sure that that's the case.
Yeah, and then the other thing, can you imagine, you're old enough to be able to appreciate this, can you imagine using a four-letter expletive to your mother?
Oh, my gosh. No, not whatsoever. No,
you'd fall off the chair, too. The hair in the back of the neck.
I mean, and I'm from an era where if I had said something like that, it would be my dad who would step up and do something to me that I would still remember to this day. You know, that even in our discipline, it's changed. The dynamic of the relationship has changed on so many levels, including discipline, which, if we wanted to be, academic and argumentative about a few points, we could go back to what happened to the family when fathers stopped putting a hand on the kid's bottom. A swift smack on the butt solves a lot of problems in the old days, as I remember.
You bet. By the way, and I'm all for that, but that's not beating anybody. I remember in school when you got out of line, you went into the vice principal's office and he had a phone book. And you bent over, and the phone book went between your head and the wall, and he had a paddle. And if you popped up, you got another swat, and you did not want to go in there. Were we beaten? No. Were we emotionally destroyed? No. We just knew you didn't do that again.
Right, and you grew up a law-abiding, respectful citizen. My wife is a school teacher, and she teaches in the special ed environment where there are challenging students. And it astonishes me every time she comes home to tell me a story about the misbehavior that she was not able to do anything about. And it's just a sad thing to me to see that, we get so concerned about kids feeling affirmed, and we're afraid that consequenting children somehow is not an affirming thing, when actually it's just the opposite. I think it expresses concern and love when you set somebody straight while they're heading in the wrong direction.
Sure, and also you teach them that there are people who win and people who lose if you're in sports. And if you lose, you've won by playing, but if you lose, it means you just go out and get better so you can win the next time. That's
right.
That competitive thing that's being taken away also. So everybody should sit down and appreciate Mom, because it is a very special day. And I've got the books in front of me, by the way. They're great.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think if you let this touch you, and you begin to understand the dynamic of what makes a mom, no matter what the culture is, because no matter what, a mom is still a mom is still a mom.
It's still a mom, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I refer to my mother as mom or mother. I don't call her mommy anymore. I'm a few years too old for that, but I certainly never call her by her first name or anything but mom. And I still say I love you each time I speak to her, and she certainly kisses me in the mouth every time she sees me.
Sure.
And that's really one of the wonderful things about moms. You know, where dads may think that you outgrow the need for affection, or that you've just become men and don't need to touch, your mother will never think that she doesn't want to touch you, or that you're too old to be hugged. And that's a wonderful thing to go home and feel like, if I could sit in her lap, she would probably let me.
Sure. And by the way, one other thing, Greg, we're starting to run out of time, but one other thing that I think is very important with this, you and I have obviously had good relationships with our mothers. For those of you out there that do not have a good relationship, sit her down this Mother's Day and clear it up, because deep down, they want it cleared. They want to be mom. They want to be in that role, no matter what it looks like outside.
I couldn't agree with you more. Everyone is not blessed enough with, or not everyone is blessed with a healthy, functioning family. Some of us come from fractured families, but even those families can be healed. And if you just sit down and take the initiative, make the apology or to ask for forgiveness and or just reach out in a way that is positive and affectionate, you begin to, you know, just rebuild the relationship where hopefully in the end you can look at one another and be glad that you were in each other's life.
Oh, no question. Greg Lang, we're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
It's my full name, GregoryELang.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Greg, thank you so much for joining us. The books are great, and I hope everybody gets them and give Mom a little bit of love this Mother's Day.
It's my pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michelle Pava is with us, a 20-plus-year media professional who is focused on science, medicine, health, and wellness, along with advocacy and public affairs. While working in media, she's been a wellness professional and a personality. She's been an author and a publisher, and she's authored over 11 books, and her focus is to help empower others to success in body, mind, and spirit. Her latest book is Fatitude, Lose Your F in Attitude, Lose Fat, Fear, Frustrations, Fibromyalgia, and More. And Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I wanted to say that your last guest really hit it with affirmation and consequences, because that's what it's all about. Whether it's with families or with your weight and your wellness, it's all about knowing the difference between when do you stop with the affirmations and when do you start looking at consequences.
Now, by the way, fat, fear, frustration, fibromyalgia, don't they all stem from the same place?
You know what? They really do. And a lot of it has to do with just hormone levels. And we are walking around with an incredible amount of toxins. Even those who are the most well-meaning and purchasing everything organic, we still have more toxins now in the air and in the water than we did even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and especially 20 and 30 years ago. So we're already fighting quite a bit, even if we're doing our best efforts. And that's what a lot of people don't understand is, you know, they'll say, well, I'm buying organic. Well, but you're breathing the air, and our air is so much more toxic. So, you know, a couple of things that I really thought would be important that really would help a wide area of people is, you know, talking about metabolism, because a lot of people don't understand metabolism at all.
Okay,
and,
define it.
Metabolism is actually just the thermal effect of your body. And there are so many people who say, oh, I have a slow metabolism, or they'll say to someone else, you must have a fast metabolism. Well, we're not cars, we're humans, and there is no such thing as a slow or a fast metabolism. It's either functional or dysfunctional. So if you're too thin or you're too heavy, now there could be a lot of other health issues going on, but usually 90% of the time, it's actually because you have a dysfunctional metabolism. So if you really think about what you eat, 50% is actually just keeping you alive. About 20% is used just for activity. And 30%, which is a huge portion, is used to heal your metabolism, keep it going, and for your whole digestive process. So if you're eating junk food, you're actually already at a 50% fail rate for your wellness or in your digestive system or just in your energy level. So if you're not eating, that's why when people do not eat appropriately, they don't have a lot of energy. It's actually because they're technically starving themselves of nutrients, but they're still getting stuff. So what's happening is their body is holding on to everything because your body is craving nutrition. Therefore, it's actually holding on to so much that you're gaining weight because your body doesn't know the difference. It's just thinking, I'm hungry. I need something. And it holds on to everything.
Yeah, by the way, Michelle, let me throw this out at you, because what I'm listening to you say, and I think it's a critically important, it's balancing chemicals, because your body's like, and your brain's like an electrochemical factory, and it, mm-hmm. and the key word was nutrients, not diets. It's nutrients. What you take in is going to cause the chemical reactions that will make you feel good, feel bad, be healthy, or be non-healthy, and I think you're
exactly.
hitting it right there.
And, you know, and that's the program that I have is specifically, and you don't even, you know what, of course I would love everybody to buy my book, but you know what, if they could start literally right now and just stop eating processed food. Most people, when they stop eating processed food, within 3 to 6 weeks, and I mean strict, no processed food, within 3 to 6 weeks, they will start feeling so much better. They will have less insomnia. Their thyroid will even out. If they have thyroid issues, and that's a whole, you know, that's a whole other issue, because it's sure. not just, you know, there's so many people walking around right now with thyroid medication, and then they go back to the doctor and they have to up the medication. What's really happening is not, now I can't say 100% of the time, but much of the time, it's not really that your thyroid is the problem. It is that you're not, number one, unless you're eating a lot of seafood, you're not getting enough iodine. Number two, cortisol and our stress levels, and because we're not eating correctly, so we're not metabolizing correctly, our cortisol levels are skyrocketing. What happens when that skyrockets? You don't usually get tested for your cortisol level at the regular doctor appointment. You just get thyroid testing. So you're not seeing what's causing the thyroid problem, which is actually sometimes, often, your cortisol levels. So if your cortisol level is blocking the synthesis, it throws the numbers off and it makes you feel bad. So a key to that is really coping with your stress. We're all walking around where we're type A people, and it's actually considered a compliment if you multitask or you do too much. And that's really very backwards. We're supposed to be very peaceful types of people that really can focus and are happy and healthy. So we're actually, you know, we're giving like a kudos to people who are driving themselves into graves. And it's a very sad society when we have to be that way.
Now, stress comes on when you go over that line in the sand where you can cope mm-hmm. and you can deal with things. And that coping level gets less and less if you're not eating the right foods. Because I'm going to go
exactly.
all the way back to, everything you've said is balancing your chemicals. When you talk about synthesis, mm-hmm. that's incorporating it and allowing it to happen. And you said it early on, and I forgot which one it was, but you can have this is off the top of my head. You have B12, which is good for your blood. It's going to put iron in your blood. And if you don't have enough iron, and they say take B12, if you don't take something mm-hmm. else with it, it doesn't synthesize into the blood. It goes
exactly.
into the bones. Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean,
and B12 is also fantastic. I'm glad you brought that up. B12 to me is like the wonder vitamin. If you're going to take anything and you're in a typical stressed lifestyle, take B12, because B12 is zapped out of your life with any kind of stress. And actually, I want to mention there's something called eustress. There's stress and there's eustress. Eustress is a happy stress. Getting married, getting an A on a test, getting a new car, all of those things still cause excitement, and they still actually rob you of nutrients. So So even when you have wonderful things happening in your life, you're still actually using all of those nutrients, you're still metabolizing, and you still have to be very aware that even the happiest person needs to be aware of what they're taking in and their activity level. And I am actually, not that I down working out at all, but anyone who is a slave to the gym or someone who has to work out to keep weight off, that's a big red flag that they're actually kind of doing a little bit of a faux problem solving. So what it's telling me is that they are actually in such a dysfunctional place that they actually have to work that hard to look like they're in a normal place. But once they heal their metabolism, they don't have to work out so hard. So
by the way,
I'm a big fan of...
I'm an old gym rat, okay? And I have... You're right. I have... You know what the big heavy boxer's bags look like, the big heavy bag?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And it's called Barney the Beat-Up Bag. And then when things get a little too stressful, I yell down here and I say, Barney, I'm coming. And he said, come on, Dad, I'm ready. But it's the key is to be mindful about it and know what you have to do to get it done. In addition to, I absolutely, totally am on your side of the table here with about what you put into your body is going to affect every facet of your body or your mind.
Oh,
your emotions.
It's so important. Yeah. It's important even for learning. Children, you know, if they're not, if you think of all the junk food, you know, the average child is eating cereal, packaged foods. Maybe mom or dad is really working hard and they don't actually find enjoyment in cooking, so they're either doing takeout or fast food at night, and then there's the processed snacks. How much is that child really eating that is actually helping that 50% to keep them alive, the 20% of their energy level, and the 30% for their digestive system? So if you really look at that, they're already fighting so many battles before they even walk into that schoolroom, you know, and they, and that's where a lot of this, like, you know, the problems with children, you know, if you really look at it, well, if you're feeding your kid nothing but toxins and sugar and dyes and preservatives, how can they behave correctly? I mean, and it's just, there's something called the Feingold diet, which is fabulous for children. Every parent should go online and check that out because it really gives you so much concrete information on what all of these things do to a child. And my own child was, I used to have junk food around the house. My own child was having all kinds of problems, and we put him on the Feingold diet, and that is what inspired me to do more research into all of this. My child went from a struggling child in 3 weeks to considered gifted. So in 3 weeks, and it was just minor, just taking him off of products with yellow dye. And we're talking Gatorade, we're talking a lot of pizzas, you know, things like that. And all of that can make such a difference. So if it can do that to a child, think of the productivity in adults and think of common sense in adults, how that would change, you know. So it's very important.
Yeah, and I really believe a couple of the messages that you have here, one is to be mindful. Mindful meaning don't go through life accidentally, go through life intentionally. Be intentional about how you want your body to be and how do you want your emotions, your spirituality, and everything that goes along with it. You have the choice to do so. It all starts, though, with what you put into your mouth.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the things that I really go into, and one thing that people often tell me about my book, and I'm a very spiritual person, religious person. I care about people. I want people to be empowered. But I knew to get people's attention, I would have to do something drastic. So the title of the book is a little bit different, and it makes people think of a little something edgy, and I do write that way. So a lot of people say, oh, it's comical, it's funny, but it's really in your face, and it made me think that you were talking to me. And the thing is, it's all about choices. And if you know that you have that choice, and anyone who's listening, if they know right now they're sitting at home, maybe they don't feel well, or maybe they could use a, you know, lose a few pounds, if they know that they are in control and they have choices, and again, it goes back to that affirmation and consequences, everything that you do right now will affect you tomorrow. And, you know, for instance, one huge thing, make sure you drink enough water. When people think that when they drink water, they're flushing the fat out. That's why they think they're losing weight. Well, the fat is in your cells, so it's not really flushing out, maybe out of your intestines, but that's about it. But what the water is doing is if your cells are dehydrated, they actually hang on to anything that it can. They want, you know, H2O, but they will hang on to fat to keep hydrated, because in order to stay alive, your cells need to be hydrated. Well, when you start drinking enough water, the cells shrink because they do not need to have the fat on them. So the fat then dislodges and disintegrates. So
sure.
That is fabulous, and then it flushes out through your blood, yada, yada. But people don't realize something that simple, by staying hydrated, can keep them thinner, and they're going to be more alert, and they're going to rest better at night. And that's huge. I mean, people really, I want people to be able to get over fibromyalgia and thyroid issues, and even for men, impotence. I mean, it's a subject that people don't talk about, but it's really serious, because many men, 70% of men who have heart attacks first have impotence in some way. That is a precursor to a heart attack.
You know how to tell? No, I'm serious.
How to tell if there's
impotence? I'm serious. Do you know how to tell? There's a very easy way to tell. A lot of ED happens because of not enough blood flow. I mean, that's common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at a man's legs, if he's got very hairy legs, and I'm being serious now, if he's got very hairy legs,
true.
It means there's a lot of blood flow. If he has a little bit of hair on his legs or not much at all, that's a sign that there are problems there and the blood isn't flowing. You might find varicose veins. You might find any number of things. And that in and of itself will tell you a lot of the guys that don't have a lot of hair on their legs have the problem that you're talking about.
Exactly. And you know what? To add to that, there's also something, also a very taboo subject, but very serious. Men often, it could start as early as age 35, just like with women, they do go through hormonal changes. And it's
sure.
very, very important for men to get tested if they start to feel tired, if they're losing hair. Now, of course, some hair loss is genetic, but like you said, hair on the legs,
sure.
if they don't have the libido, all of that actually can mean that they have some hormone dysfunction. And it's very important to get that checked out, not just for the sexual perk of it all, but actually men are more prone to have a stroke, depression, suicide, all of that. And it's so important. These are all things that really can be addressed early on, and it's very confidential, it is medical, and it's very important. And so any woman, if you're with someone who has some of these issues, please be alert. Any man, please have the confidence to go and get checked. It's super
sure.
important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, this is not an off-color issue, I would bring this up in your talking points in every place mm-hmm. that you do talk in the media, because I think it's a very important issue, and you handle it professionally, so it is something to look at. And in today's world, with more and more of these things going on, if you don't have a place to go, you don't have a direction, then you can have a lot of problems. It's not just the ED itself, it's the problems that can come from that, and you mentioned a few of them. So there's a myriad mm-hmm. of problems to take a look at. So you mention it, you realize that, well, that's not the worst thing in the world, and you go fix it. And most of it's
right,
fixable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's the scary thing, is that that's why it's so important, why I called the book Fatitude, Lose Your F in Attitude, because I wanted to be, of course, a little bit edgy. I wanted people to take notice, because you can cure a lot of your own ills by just being mindful, like you said. And I am very interested in yoga. I love yoga, and it's all about mindfulness. I'm interested in religions, all religions. Again, they deal a lot with mindfulness. And people that have fears, anxieties, even anxiety can come from just the way you're eating, because if you're not digesting properly, or if you're not metabolizing properly, your cells will create a different path, basically, and you will behave differently. And that behavior will result sometimes in anxiety, phobias, panic attacks, and it can be as simple as drinking more water or upping your B12 or cutting out processed foods. And, everything, I'm not against medicine in any way, shape, or form, but a lot of things can be dealt with before you start popping a lot of pills that maybe you're not really addressing the root issue, but the symptoms. And if you don't address the root issue, the symptoms are compounding.
Michelle, medicine came from mm-hmm. food in the first place. You've got conventional, traditional medicine, and the traditional medicine were herbs, was food, and then it was processed into the chemicals. So, yes, there is a place for all of it, no question. But if you go mm-hmm. back to basics, that's a lot healthier. I think it was when we introduced McDonald's to Japan, the staple food was fish. The moment that we did something like that, the amount of colon cancer went, it skyrocketed. So you're dealing with those kind of things.
Yeah.
It's all in,
and it's it's so sad because, you know, and I really do, and I, you know, I'm sounding very serious right now, but I really do write in a very lighthearted, fun way, and really in your face. Like, it's a very, you know, abrupt kind of style, but I back it up with everything that I write is backed up with science that I've researched, whether it was from, I mean, myself, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. I kicked it in 3 weeks. I mean, I was told at one point, oh, your thyroid's off. I researched it. I mean, so a lot of it is really from, you know, some issues that I went through and 20 years of working with people and 25 years of being a medical and health writer. And thank God having access to many, many scientists and doctors and just amazing people. So I just, it's so important because I look at the generations and I look at these children who think that fast food is normal. And when I was growing up, it was like a big deal to have a TV dinner. It was like a fun, strange, interesting thing. And my mother never knew having a TV dinner. My mother grew up in an orphanage. So, you know, everything was just very basic. But I'll tell you, people were healthier before. And we talk about how we've come so long with medical science and so forth, and we have in many ways, but sometimes we abuse that. You know, sometimes a good thing in excess is not good. So pills are good, but not in excess. You know, antibiotics are good, but not in excess. So that's the problem that we run into where, you know, is it really that much quicker to buy fast food if you have to go run and buy it? Wouldn't it just be easier to cook something at home, learn how to freeze some foods? And by the way, there is in the book and online, and actually you can go anywhere and find amazing recipes that you can freeze, put into portions, take them out. It's better than fast food. It's healthy for you, and you've made it from scratch. You know exactly what's in it. There's not anybody's hand with E. coli in it. I mean, it's healthier. So I really just, you know, if nothing else, if I just get the message across to people that no matter how down they feel right now, no matter what issues they have going on, you can definitely empower yourself. I have a woman who is 40 years old. She is in a retirement center, basically an assisted living center. She has MS, severe, a lot of other issues going on. And she went on my program, and she lost 15 pounds in meat, like, within the first, like, month, and she felt better. Other people have gone off their cholesterol medicine, and it's just been incredible feedback, and I'm just so, I really feel blessed that I'm able, that I was able to interview so many people in order to come to these, I guess, awakenings. I don't even know what you would call them, because, I
sure.
Mean,
Michelle, I hate to
hear
this.
A lot of it is common sense.
I know, we're starting to run out of time, but website we can find you at where we can buy the book.
Okay, well, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere, and it's called Fatitude, Lose Your F'n Attitude, and my website is actually just loseyourfnattitude.com.
Love every second of it. Michelle Bava, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Good night.
Japan and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Ray Luskin with us. She's an artist. She's an author. She's a community activist, a consultant, a keynote speaker, and the founder of Art and Soul Connections. Her brand new book is Art from My Heart, features creative projects that have been a healing effect for children and parents. She's been a guest on numerous radio programs and been featured in Family Time magazine. Hey, Ray, welcome to the show.
Oh, welcome. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much.
Looking forward to this.
Wonderful. By the way, Art from the Heart. I love the book. I've got it in my hands now. What was it that caused you to put this to pen from the beginning?
Well, there were really two things. My best friend, her granddaughter was in therapy, quote unquote. She was 10 and she hated it. You know, she just didn't know how to express herself through words. And she said, I wish you had something, you know, that she could use that would help her build her self-esteem and feel better about herself, that it wasn't about words. And it gave her a whole new way of looking at things. So that was the first thought that came to me about doing this. And the other part was taking this inspiration, because I feel so many kids are abused today, have been in difficult situations, neglected, adults too, you know, and they need different tools besides talk therapy. Not everybody responds well to talk therapy, and they need different ways of expressing themselves and finding out who they are, how to be authentic, accept their bodies just the way they are, and just different problem-solving techniques. So those were the two reasons, really.
By the way, Ray, when I've looked at art for so many years now, what I've looked at art as is this, which just flows right into what you're talking about. If you can't express, if you can't communicate, art can be an external expression of what you're holding inside. It becomes symbolic, but everything that you want to say will come out with art, and it doesn't necessarily even have to be painting.
No. When I say art, I say creative expression. It could be through dance, music, photography, the way you garden. I mean, it's a much broader concept of creativity in art that I use. Now, I happen to use mostly scribbles and doodles. I don't believe it has to be a fine piece of art. You know, so many times we'll go to a museum, we'll look at something, and you can really feel the feelings and the emotions, but there's another way to access it. And it's just as simple as using scribbles. And when I work with people, I tell them, close your eyes. There's no pressure. It's about the process, because the process gets deep into your soul and it gives you a new vocabulary that you didn't have before. And you can speak the unspeakable in ways that you didn't know. And for really small children, I even play with chocolate pudding and raisins and nuts, and they can draw that way. It takes you to a different place. There's a fun element involved, and it's not about a fine piece of art or even interpretation. It's really about an internal process that you go through.
Okay, and that internal process, you don't have to specifically say what it is. I want to let's bring up abuse at this stage. And if we talk about abuse, it can be worked out through these different art forms. If you can't say it, you can experience it out in different ways. And I think that in and of itself has got to be the door that gets open for so many people that couldn't do it through therapy, couldn't do it through conversation, could not get the words out because the words couldn't express what was going on inside them. You do it with art, all of a sudden, not only do you have who you are and what you are, there's even more there than you thought was there.
Oh, totally. There's a way to express yourself, and you don't even know half the time what's going to come up for you, you know, because our process allows you to free yourself. You go into your subconscious, you know, you can get into places and just start, it becomes, if you can use words afterwards, a lot of times, one of the workshops I took that I loved over the years was one where you dance out how you're feeling first, then you draw the experience of what it is, and then you write poetry with it. So you've used all these different modalities to express the same thing, and all of a sudden, it's totally transformative. And I think that's the key. It's not stuck in your head. It's not just in your throat. It is transformative because you've physically also released something that's happened to you.
Now, I'm going to go back to something because there was something that in your bio that I didn't get, and it's over someplace else. You lend your voice and the story and the artwork through your tube, art galleries, and lectures to end a silent epidemic and help communities create healing spaces for survivors. I'm going to go back to it. We touched on the sexual abuse, and I think it's so critically important. You went through it yourself as a child. There are so many people who do today. It's prevalent. There's no question about it. And at the same time, they don't know how to fix it. And there, I think, lies the problem.
Yes, that is, I mean, there's so many levels of this. One of the things that most people don't understand, it is a community problem. It's not that person's problem or that family's problem. It's everyone's problem because the long-term consequences are so vast. You know, there are so many cases of, you know, you get into depression and anxiety and suicide and cutting and all these substance abuse issues. And when you track it back and you finally start asking the right questions, you'll find out it came from an abusive situation as a child. So a lot of times we treat the symptom and we don't even understand the whole component of it. And that also then when a survivor doesn't tell, and 30% of victims never tell a soul, which I find very scary because you spend all your life never being authentic. You can't express who you are or any of the pain that you went that went along with it. So many people suffer in silence, and that we can't fix it because a lot of people don't know it exists. They don't want to know because then they have to deal with their own, well, then I have to do something about it. Once you start talking about it, then you have to come up with solutions. And so many people don't want to come up with it because it's hard. It's a difficult subject.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And it's so difficult that most people will carry it to their grave unless they know they have, I'm going to use the word, the S word, the safe outlet. I just opened the book and I went to the family page and I thought it was great. A family hero, you know, the best traits. Why do you like them? And instead of thinking about all the negative things that there are, the book inspires you to come up with the other side of that, what to look for in a person, not how bad that person is, but how good that person is.
Right. We spend so much time, especially if you've been, you know, and everybody's experienced it at some time in their life. Somebody said something that hurt your feelings. You're fat, you're stupid, you're ugly, boys don't cry, you know, and you take that as becomes a core belief in who you are, and everything you do is based on that statement. So my intent in the book is to have you start looking at the other side. What are the other voices? What's wonderful, magnificent about you or somebody else in your community so you can emulate them and see that how much you are like them, not how different you are.
Yeah, and we've seen so many people today, if you talk to a couple of kids, 15, 17, 18 years old, and listen to the conversation, it's about how bad somebody is, how nasty they are, and so on and so forth. And it's got to be that turnaround time. Instead of looking for the worst in somebody, if you can get that mindset to look for the best in them, and then you begin to recognize that. Because if you look for the worst, Ray, you're going to find the worst.
Exactly. We need, you know, I've been very, I'm always on Twitter these days and Facebook and things like that, and I'm always saying, picture a world without violence. What would the news be like? What would our vocabulary be? How would you act with someone? You know, same thing. What would a world be filled with peace or love? And you got to start turning it around. You know, let's have peace rooms instead of war rooms. You know, I'm a big believer in the vocabulary we use and how we say and phrase things.
Yeah, and now, by the way, I think you got a great way to go because it said that you were an activist from Chicago, and I know somebody who was a Chicago activist who ended up to be the president of the United States.
So that's very true. Those grassroots efforts, they do pay off. What can I tell you?
Sure.
Chicago's a great city to be in. The community, I've been active in this arena for, 16, 17 years. And it goes back further than that. And the changes over the period of time. At one point, it was only a women's issue. Now there are men involved. Now there are communities and action steps people are willing to take to start talking about this, you know, that I can get out there and actually, you know, I'm part of this group that, a safe synagogue, program of certification. And we go in and I tell my story and I show my artwork and I talk about why don't kids tell? Why don't adults tell? How can you create a healing community? Because if they don't hear my story, they won't be able to do anything about it because they don't have the understanding and the breadth and depth of what it can do to somebody and what they also need to do on the other end to create that healing safe space.
And I want to touch on this because we've got about 3-4 minutes left, but I want to make sure we get to this. The Strong Women Share Secret movement, what is that?
I started that this year, and I'm hoping in this coming year that we get 100,000 women who are willing to come forward and share their story, because I think there is healing for them and the community, and they can stand in their power. For so many people have kept their secret for so long, and I encourage them to find the medium that they want to use, whether it's art and poetry. And there are many different websites online, Lavender Power and some other ones right now, Breaking the Silence, where they will post your artwork, your poetry, your video, whatever you want to do that says who you are, what experience you had. Because I think it's really, those are the action steps I want people to take for themselves, because it'll be healing for them, it'll be healing for the community.
Absolutely.
And
well,
place.
Yeah.
A lot of times you may tell a therapist, but you never told your family what really happened.
And by the way, absolutely. But beyond the therapist, it's, you've said the word community. There is a community out there, and there are a tremendous amount of people who will, if they're asked to support, they will support. But the problem, Ray, is they've never been asked to support. And when they realize that there's a place where they can add, they can create their own identity, they can get camaraderie, and most important, connection, which so many people lose today, then all of a sudden you've got a movement that moves, it rocks, and it gets where you want it to go.
Oh, there, so true. And social media has made a big difference. I have to say, Facebook, people are on there all the time, and they're supporting one another. And some, in the beginning, it's usually somebody doesn't show their face, they don't necessarily tell their real name, and then all of a sudden they become bolder and stronger, and they belong to each other, and they belong with each other, and they start sharing that. So all of a sudden you get a picture of who they really are. And it's so beautiful to see when they do connect, and that we can all make a difference, that it will not be a silent epidemic in, you know, another 20 years. Hopefully sooner. It will be something that we all take charge and take a part in changing.
No, absolutely, no question about it. But one of the things that I loved about Chicago, I was born there, but I left when I was 7, 8 years old. And I went back about 3 or 4 years ago. And I was born in 18-some-odd, whatever it was. That's when I was there. But I was born in Chicago and ended up in Los Angeles, raised there, and then in Fairbanks, Alaska, and down to the Milwaukee area. So we're not that far away from you. But when I went back, it was fascinating because I went back to the street where I lived as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, it's interesting. And it was like that time stood still. I was standing on that same street. I was feeling the same way I was. I walked around back where my dad's truck was parked, and it was a fascinating thing. So I'm an old Chicagoite, but I wasn't brought up there.
Okay, I've lived here all my life.
Yeah, oh, it's a good thing. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Ray, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It is rayluskin.net, RaeLuskin.net. And I have a couple freebies on there for people tonight, a little bit about art and healing if you go to my gift page. And then I also have something called a forgiveness mandala and meditation. I believe that's a big part of healing. And if you want to have a discovery session with me, you can apply. I do a lot of coaching with people and working VIP days where I will work with them one-on-one. And we do a lot of healing work using art.
Wonderful.
And
hey, Ray,
my book.
Oh, by the way, yes. And I think the book is wonderful. I have it right here. And I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Take
nice
care.
Getting to know you.
Add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing out, long as we're singing out, long as we're singing.
Hey, thanks for listening, and tell your friends about the show. That's the way we grow. And I'll tell you what, it's called networking. And I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, for tonight is a wrap.